welcome to By the Well, a lectionary podcast for preachers to help you preach the good news in your communities. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker. And we're here in the fifth Sunday after Pentecost, where the readings we're going to mention today are Genesis 24, selected verses. We're going to look at the Song of Songs, chapter 2, which is an alternate reading instead of the psalm, and the verses from Matthew 11. And here today to help us do this is a special guest whose arm I twisted to come and join us, the Reverend Brian Kalia. Brian is a PhD student up at Whitley College in the University of Divinity, where he's working on a PhD in Hebrew Bible. Thank you for joining us, Brian.
Pleasure to be here.
I should also say Brian is a preacher and ordained in the Congregational Christian Church.
Of Samoa?
Yeah.
Yep.
Of Samoa. Tell us, thank you for coming, Brian. Can you give us some idea what your PhD is focusing on?
Yeah, so I'm writing on the, specifically on the book of Ecclesiastes, mm-hmm. With, of course, talking on resonances with the rest of wisdom literature mm-hmm. in the Hebrew Bible. And I'm choosing to write from a diasporic perspective.
Right.
Given that I'm a diasporic identity, mm-hmm. Being an Australian-born Samoan. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to locate Qohelet, the author of Ecclesiastes, in the diaspora, and I'm looking at finding resonances within Ecclesiastes with that mindset of critiquing wisdom and mm-hmm. traditions from the point of view of a diasporic identity. So that's pretty much in a nutshell what I'm writing about.
That's intriguing. Intriguing. Yeah. Have you had many occasions where you've preached on Ecclesiastes?
I have. Not as much as I'd want to, mm-hmm. But given our church context, we follow a specific lectionary, much like this one. So mm-hmm. I guess the only time I would preach on Ecclesiastes is if it's the assigned text for that Sunday, or if it's a New Testament, because we tend to do both New Testament and Old Testament or Hebrew Bible text. So mm-hmm. if I can find a resonance of a New Testament text with Ecclesiastes, then I'll use Ecclesiastes
to help unpack it.
Yeah. To unpack it, yeah.
Yes, because sometimes with texts like Ecclesiastes and like Song of Songs today, these don't appear in the lectionary, in many lectionaries very often, so we don't often get to hear their voices, which is a shame.
Well, it's interesting that you point that out, Robin, because I think just last week I was just flicking through our lectionary, and I think in the whole of 2020, there was only one day assigned to Ecclesiastes. Yeah. So, yeah.
We've got a Uniting Church minister just local to here, Craig Thompson, who actually did a long series on Ecclesiastes. It's right on his website.
Yeah, just throw out the lectionary for a while.
Yeah, threw it out for
sometimes
a while.
Sometimes it's worth doing that to help your church.
Fantastic. Yeah.
It's great.
So let's bring a little of that lens to our readings, and it's probably most apparent in the Genesis 24 reading, mm-hmm. where we're up to the story of Abraham really working behind the scenes to ensure that a wife is found for his son in what is a kind of handing over to the next generation. Brian, can I just throw to you, what do you think we need to notice about this text, or what grabs you if you were to preach on this?
Well, just the whole the creativity of Abraham's servant is what mm-hmm. is something that captured mm-hmm. me, especially with the rhetoric that he uses. His a careful choice of words mm-hmm. when he's relaying the messages between him and Abraham to Laban when they're in conversation, and the way he manipulates the words and edits out bits and, you know, chop and change to sort of fit the what the whole purpose behind his mission to Laban. So I think that part of the story, I mean, just chapter 24 I think is the longest chapter in the whole of Genesis. And you know, it might sound from the outset that it's, you know, going to be long-winded, but when you sort of do those comparisons of what happens in the conversation between Abraham and the servant, and then the servant with Laban, it makes it a lot more interesting and intriguing to sort of see those different, you know, nuances in what the
in what each one says.
Yeah.
Can you give an example of what's the sorts of things he shifts?
Yeah. So I think the major reservation that Abraham had with finding a wife for Isaac was the idea of not wanting to marry the Canaanite women.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And that was particularly paramount in the mindset of Abraham as he was relaying the mission for the mm-hmm.
Do you know why? Just on the side note on the Canaanites, why might there be that?
Well,
prejudice, we might say.
That's right. I mean, I think the prejudice towards the Canaanites is quite evident throughout the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
And I think where it sort of echoes off that being heard here.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the attitudes towards foreigners and specifically Canaanites here is something that's sort of reflective of, a society that are trying to establish themselves, a nation that are trying to establish their foothold in the promised land, and therefore trying to maintain their purity.
Yeah.
When we talk purity, I use the term purity in relation to religious purity, which is something that is fundamental in the Hebrew Bible.
I think that's the most compelling argument why the Canaanite preference is made to avoid the Canaanite community for a source of a wife. But I did also think about Abraham's own predicament where he'd been sent in Genesis 12 away from your family and your country and whether at that level going home for a wife is also significant for him. But I think the text is operating a bit more theologically like you were suggesting.
Well, I mean, it's another way of looking at it. And the text certainly allows for those things, for those types of insights to come forth. But for me, when you read what's going on there between Abraham and the servant, and then you look at the servant's conversation with Laban, the emphasis changes, and it changes from stressing what Abraham is really reserved about, to more trying to sell. The idea of bringing Rebecca back to be Isaac's wife, and therefore that's when he starts talking about the riches and all
the wealth, the gifts, and the wealth. Yes,
that's right. So
it's like almost like saying this is a great match for her because look how rich Abraham is, and all of that will go to Isaac.
It. Yeah, in essence, it is.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a good marriage. I'm fascinated that the initial interaction takes place at a well. And later in the Bible, all sorts of interesting things happen between men and women at wells. Jacob and Rachel will meet at a well and then marry. Moses will meet his future wife, Zipporah, at a well. Jesus will meet the Samaritan woman where there's questions about relationship status in John's gospel by a well. Should we read into that? Is this a romantic encounter? Potentially.
Well, that's it is interesting, and I can see you laughing, Robin, because
we did maybe talk about this earlier.
I think that the well sort of acts as a metaphor for rendezvous, obviously, but for in the examples that you mentioned, a love rendezvous, which is really interesting in this chapter because. You know, the question is who are meeting by the well here? And if we are to, imagine the love rendezvous, it's not Isaac and Rebecca, but it's Rebecca and the servants. A lot of the conversations, the wooing of Rebecca and the enticing of Rebecca to come back, it falls on the shoulders of the servant. And if he's not convincing, then, he's failed, and that's probably his reservation compared to, and his anxiety compared to Abraham, is that he doesn't want his mission to fail.
Mm.
So there's a lot of effort here by the servants to try and woo, and it takes place at the well.
Nice, and we will get to more love poetry in a moment. Heads up. But I also wanted to ask about the veil because there's an interesting lifting of veil and closing of veil. What might that signify, and or any other details in the text that you sort of think are interesting for us to note?
Well, it's interesting that the veil's mentioned, and I mean immediately, without even looking at Song of Songs, I thought about Song of Songs straight away, because veil is in the ancient Near East, love poetry and the literature of the ancient Near East. The veil is a symbol and metaphor for virginity, and it's a prominent theme in the Book of Song of Songs. So the idea of the veil being, that Rebecca puts on is a symbol that, she's protecting her virginity in preparation for marriage. Mm. And I it's interesting as well, and this might be just my own way of looking at it. The implication there when you read the text is that she had it off, the veil off, because it says she put it back on.
Mm.
So all sorts of questions start to arise.
What was happening at that well?
Yeah. Yes. What was going on with the servant on that long journey home?
That's right.
I think what is significant here, what we're seeing is an arranged marriage quite clearly, but the author thought it important enough to say that Isaac loved her.
Yeah.
So they got married. That was all organised by the community, as was custom, but he loved her.
Yeah. It is a poignant note to end on. Mm. We also see here, in the grand theme, I think this, Fran and I have talked before about the epic and the lyric.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the grand epic narrative, this is about God's promises being passed on to a new generation.
Yep.
Sarah has died. Mm. Rebecca's now the new matriarch. Abraham has passed on to Isaac. Isaac has literally moved from this Beer Lahairoi to Negev to the south. So there's shifting away from his perhaps birthplace or a place associated with Ishmael to establish this new generation for the promise. But at the lyric level, for preachers, it occurs to me too, there's a lovely theology here that this is a migrant family struggling with living at distance and how to, think about the next generation and caring for them and kinship and the importance of family. And in those very human details of where will I find a wife and what will my family look like and how do I take care of them, there is a sense that God is there as part of that picture and God is actually ahead of them and God is active in those just very domestic moments as well, which I thought was quite lovely. But let's move on to Song of Songs, sometimes called Song of Solomon.
Mm.
Why is it called both those things?
Well, I think the tradition of Solomon as the author of this poem or this anthology of poems has led to this name, Song of Solomon. There's the technique that they use of pseudo authors.
Yeah, the pseudepigraphal.
Pseudepigraphal. And, by placing this book in the authority of Solomon, it gives it authority. But the name itself, Shir HaShirim, which are the first few words of the book, which means which translates as Song of Songs, is why it's also called Song of Songs. So
most Hebrew Bible scholars I know prefer that because that's actually the title in the text.
Is that a bit like Holy of Holies?
Yeah.
You know, like the most beautiful song? Is that that phrase,
song above all, or
song above,
that's the sense, exactly the sense of it, and it's interesting to know that when in the Passover, this is the main text, Song of Songs. So they read this during the Passover, the Jewish Passover.
Look, it's so beautiful.
Exactly,
and probably makes some Christians a bit uncomfortable, right? it's a bit erotic. Love poetry. We know there were other examples of this in the ancient world, Mesopotamian love poetry, Egyptian, we see Hellenistic. It's not obvious. I actually, when I used to teach Intro to Old Testament, I would give my students a couple of verses of this and some other things and make them guess which one was in the Bible and which one wasn't. And they often can't identify this as a biblical text because it doesn't mention God.
That with 11 and 12 girls at the school where I was a chaplain. This sort of stuff is in the Bible. It would have been interesting to be a fly on the wall when they decided to put it in and, you know,
yeah.
what the naysayers were saying.
Yes.
Well, in the tradition of you know, the canon, the Hebrew canon, there wasn't much argument in relation to including mm-hmm. Song of Songs in there.
It's only
the Christians who went and got all precious about it.
Yeah, and well, one of the arguments by, you know, in rabbinic mm-hmm. tradition and the well-known Rabbi Akiba,
mm.
He was the one that said, you know, there's no reason for us to exclude this book.
Mm.
This is, in his words, he says, this is the holiest book of all.
Wow.
So it's quite interesting that wasn't much argument.
Do you have a sense of how Jews traditionally, in that particularly in that rabbinic period, I guess, translated this? Was it simply seen as a very human to human love, erotic love poem, or was it always given some allegorical kind of meaning?
Yes, I think, and that's probably where our Christian tradition of allegorical reading stemmed from, was the allegorical readings that the Jewish tradition gave.
Yeah, so that this is about God.
And Israel. Yes,
God's love for Israel. Yep.
And hence why it's read at the Passover.
Yeah, mm. yep. Because I must say the first time I ever heard a sermon on this text, and it wasn't in a Uniting Church, I don't think I've ever heard a Uniting Church sermon on this text.
If you were at my wedding.
I was at your wedding.
We actually did have reading from
Okay, I take that back. Eight. I've heard one sermon from Fran's wedding where I was clearly distracted by other things. But in that they did a total allegorical reading of this is Christ's love for the church. And I remember thinking, no. Yeah. this is also very human, but it can, of course, be both. It's poetry. And
Well, that's the whole premise of so my master's thesis, I wrote it on Song of Songs. And the whole premise behind it was that I was talking more about our Psalm 1 readership.
Mm.
This might apply also to other Christian contexts. Is that we tend to do this really highly spiritualized reading of Song of Songs, but paying no real respect to the imagery that's in there, because the imagery is quite provocative and erotic. And you know, if that's the nature of these texts, then surely there's a responsibility among the reader to read this and to make meaning based on those imageries.
Mm.
So, yeah.
So how would you preach this, or what angle might you take with this particular section? And we've only got one little bit of the song.
So. in this section, it's really interesting because, you know, once I read that, I just automatically saw the echoes with the story in Genesis that we just read.
Mm.
Mm. You know, the whole wooing of the woman protagonist and by the man and the sense of desire, yearning, the longing, it's all in there in the story of Genesis. If we focus on the transaction between
the servant man and Rebecca.
It's not as apparent in between Isaac and Rebecca, but you know the dialogue between the relationship between the servant and Rebecca it just comes to the fore after reading Song of Songs, you know, and it makes it interesting, gives it another element. The story in Genesis another element.
Yeah, it does.
There's also imagery of being in a garden throughout this book.
Yeah.
Have you got something to comment about that?
Well, you know, with the garden, you know, springtime, you know, it's a universal concept that's associated with love. So, you know, it just gives that whole ambience and environment of love that gives it a perfect backdrop so that, you know, there would be no other place. I mean, it'd either be a garden or at the beach, you know, those are the two sort of scenes that you could sort of picture.
Yeah. Something I was reading, which you may think is an overreading, but that it's echoing Eden, the Garden of Eden.
Mm.
And this is the innocence of this couple compared to the first couple, and once they'd eaten the fruit.
That's right.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
And so they're naked, but they're not ashamed and fully present to each other.
Yes. Right. A friend of mine, Elaine James, wrote her PhD on Song, and she has actually a really helpful little article on this text on the Working Preacher site we can link to, where she talked about the garden imagery and in lots of ways, partly in terms of our ethical responsibility to the environment, that it is woven into the very fabric of what of how humans are described using these naturalistic images. But I also couldn't help but notice there's so much hope in here. And you think of young love, right, when everything is just hopeful and anticipatory and you can't think of anything else. I mean, all these images of like buds and the winter has passed, there's so many just delightful, joyful images that could invite us to think in all sorts of ways about where we notice those things in our lives or beyond just erotic love.
That's
mean,
And another thing that's interesting that sort of ties in with what you're saying is that we see the way that the man acts in this. He's very respectful. You know, he doesn't force the issue. He doesn't impose himself. And that's the whole thing with using words to try and woo people is that you're keeping your distance. Respectfully,
yes,
and you're not using any form of force or physical, you know, to try and gain the love of a person. But you're relying on your words. You're relying, and this is where it resonates with the servant, with Abraham's servant, relying on his words to try and woo this woman. But he's not going to marry her; someone else is.
Yeah, he's doing it for another cause. Yeah.
I mean, we're so schooled in the Greek tradition, really, with the dualism of body and soul, and the lesser nature of that of the material and the bodily. This is a really positive challenge. I mean, that alone could be a preaching theme in some communities.
That's it.
Yeah, people have commented this is one of the few like. Unabashedly sex positive parts of the Bible. It is saying that this gift of erotic love is part of God's goodness and gift to humanity and the world.
It speaks also to the anthropology of being made in God's image, where we're focusing on the body in a very glorified manner. And you know we're no longer talking about the body as a border or the body as an oppressive thing, but we're talking about it in celebration of God's creation. You know, being made in God's image.
Going back to the level of the narrative, just occurs to me this: they keep losing each other,
<That's it.
laughs> and then refinding each other. Yeah. So I note that, and then the assumption we have that they're married. It doesn't say that they're married.
No.
I mean, I say who cares? But, you know, so, and if they are married, why are they, that is particularly, why do they keep losing each other? I mean, you know, I don't know whether you've got anything to say, whether it's just the way the narrative's there to build up tension or.
Yeah. Well, I think we must also remember that this is a collection of poems and they might not be related. To the other. I think it's a Thaler Brenner that says that this consists of like over 30 poems being put together. So you can sort of admire the work of the editor that's put this together.
Absolutely, as
it's one long narrative, which culminates, I think, in the final chapter where they do get married. It's just that the whole tossing and turning, the yarning back and forth, you know, it's all there. And I think that's a true reflection of how love is in our current context as well.
When it's not fully, I mean, I think the fact they're not married at this point is actually important for that kind of yearning, but I don't yet have you, and it's in that wooing.
Well, what's that saying? Absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Definitely. In this case.
Better than out of sight, out of mind. All right, we probably need to move on and say something about Matthew. But,
the Gospel of Matthew,
I hope people think about preaching from Song of Songs, and if not this week, maybe some other time when it appears in the lectionary or you feel like throwing the lectionary out, because it is it is a bit of our tradition that we often just overlook and ignore. Matthew 11, Fran, any thoughts? Do you like when I throw to Fran when I find the text difficult?
Well, this is a tenuous link, folks, really, and maybe we'll even edit it out. But I'm interested in verse 19 in Matthew, yet wisdom is vindicated by her deeds. Tenuous link as in that the Song of Songs is wisdom literature. And this is a reappearance in the this is a central part of Hebraic tradition, wisdom. And Jesus is being described
as here, Lady Wisdom.
As Lady Wisdom here. And I think I would preach on that this time around.
If you wanted to make some links between them.
To make some links between them and the richness of that. I mean, this is difficult. What's happening here is John the Baptist is – what he sees the Messiah as is not what he said would happen. There's not enough judgment according to him.
Not what was expected.
No, the people think that he's too austere and Jesus is too lax.
Yeah. I did love the passage today because having been a bit frustrated with social media recently, it just made me think of all the time that people are like, oh, this generation, like, oh, millennials, boomers, this. And then no matter what you do, you can't please someone. You're either too austere or you're too much a drunkard and a glutton, as Jesus gets accused
too
of.
Too harsh or too soft.
Yeah. Right. You're like, no matter what you do, there'll be some who are displeased.
You know, and then, you know, in response to that endless quandary that – yet wisdom is vindicated by her deeds, is what the author tells us.
I think if I can add, you mean, you know, with the concept of women wisdom, you know, it stems from a rather, you know, I'd be careful to say this, but you know, there's a certain misogynist attitude in that when we refer back to Proverbs, because the idea is that, you know, the typical relationship in teaching wisdom is between a male teacher and a male student. Yeah. So the use of the woman as a metaphor sort of is meant to sort of entice the young males who are being taught wisdom to help them to remember and to understand.
To make it attractive.
It attractive. So for me, this sort of decolonizes that concept when we read Jesus as being the metaphor for Matthew, we're trying to do away with those misogynist attitudes, but focus on the on women being, you know, this image of beauty and the metaphor for wisdom and agency. So I love that how we get that turned on its head when we read Matthew.
Yes. And the other thing that gets turned on its head is this idea that that in Jesus' prayer that starts in verse 25, he thanks God for revealing this wisdom to God's infants, God's children, God's little ones.
Nice.
Which again, you know, infants are traditionally not where you train the young men,
right,
as you say, not the babies. This is a word meaning like toddlers or little ones.
Nice.
So again, it's upsetting that balance of where wisdom might be shown and where we might find it and who actually can access it.
That's great.
Not the learned men necessarily.
No.
Sorry, male listeners out there. Brian said it first. No, maybe. Of course, verse 28 might appeal to lots of people as relevant for this time and place. This is the come to me, all who are weary and burdened. I will give you rest. This word for rest here is what the Septuagint or the Greek translation of the Old Testament uses for Sabbath rest. So it's a deep sense of rest, a godly rest.
That's right.
I also noticed the yoke, that Jesus' yoke is light, but it's still a yoke. And this goes with, we've seen this in Romans in recent weeks, this idea that you, like this modern concept of total freedom from anything is just a nonsense.
Yeah.
The idea is you have a yoke and you can have the yoke of the oppressors, the Roman Empire, and it's played out in various ways in the biblical tradition. But if you take on Jesus' yoke, it will be lighter.
It's quite late in human history, this misplaced notion one can be unyoked.
Yes.
Oh, perhaps even dangerous to not even realise what you're yoked by.
Well, that's right, because if you think you're unyoked, it means you're yoked to something, but you're not aware of what it is that actually either guides or demands or controls your life.
I think the image does here too for me, so in Matthew we've got this constant tension of judgment. We can't get away from that's what is laid out. It's not all love and butterflies. You know, and that's what the image of a yoke, Jesus having Jesus' yoke, does, I think. That there's a lot that could be unpacked there. Of course, the notion of yoke also takes us back to Rebecca, who has a nose ring put on her through her nose when she's betrothed to Isaac.
Yeah, and that's right. You know, if we also take on what the name Rebecca means, the Hebrew root for it means to tie down, and you know, it's the essence of tying down there for in that narrative means that she's ready. She's going to take over Sarah as the matriarch.
Thank you so much, Brian Kalea, for being with us, and we'll certainly be having you back sometime. But great to have your input today and highlighting the song text for us in particular.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. By the Wells, produced with the support of the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College. Thanks for listening.